Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. And I'm here with my co-host, Alfred Adisk, to bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. Today is Wednesday, February 22nd, 2017. Wendy Wilson will be joining us, and here be joining...
Easy for you to say.
We'll be joining the program in just a few short moments. But first, we do have the market report. Gold today was up to $82.80 for gold today at $1,239. Silver was up 8 cents today at $18.11. Platinum was up $2 at $1,008. And palladium was down 13 at 772. The USDX today was also down 0.22 at 101.23. Crude oil. Boy, I am having problems today. Crude oil is down 0.78 at 53.55. Paper markets today, another record for the Dow, up 31, 20,774. The NASDAQ was down 5 at 58.60. The S&P was down 2 at 23.62. 10-year yield, 2.42%, down 0.1. Euro, 106. Of course, that was up 0.33. European and Asian markets basically unchanged overnight. I guess it's now time to introduce Wendy Wilson from Apothecary Herbs. Good afternoon, Wendy.
Good afternoon, Melody, and hello, Al.
Hello, Wendy.
How's everybody today? Good?
Mm-hmm. Yep, can't complain.
Awesome. Well, I thought we would talk about a couple of cold, flu, and pain meds that seem to be increasing the risk of heart attacks. So the anti-inflammatory pain relievers on the market, according to research, says they could increase your risk of heart attack. So the Infectious Disease Society of America, in conjunction with the National Health Insurance Program in Taiwan, they analyzed 7 years of data from 2005 to 2011 on the increased incidence of heart attacks when patients used common pain, cold, and flu anti-inflammatory type meds. So specifically, the medications fall into the drugs called the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. And they're often prescribed for things like respiratory infections, your common cold, and even influenza. So the research was published in February 2017 in the Journal of Infectious Disease. And what the research team looked at was all these patient records, like 10,000 patients that got admitted to the hospital for heart attacks. And what they wanted to see, if there's any correlation between acute respiratory infections and the use of these non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs and heart events. Now, some of the patients had a history of heart attack, and they were looking at all this drug use and each event, and this is what they discovered. They said the risk of heart attack is 3.5 times greater when you take pain relievers for the common cold and flu. They also said the risk increases to 7.2 times greater if you're using the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories to help with the symptoms of cold and flu. Did you guys hear about this?
No, I haven't heard a word about it, and this is not a small thing. We're talking 350%, 250%. This should be, I don't know, are they putting it in the fine print where they give you your warning, the Surgeon General's warning about...
We got some things to uncover here. So this particular 2017 report, well, the heart attack is a serious event, but they especially found that when you add the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories to the intravenous drip, So patients who had acute respiratory infections and were in the hospital, and they avoided the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, and also the pain medicines, their heart rate risk or their heart attack risk dropped by 2.7%. They also found that if patients did not have any respiratory infection but took the medications for another reason, their heart risk was 1.5 times greater. So obviously this is that an infection with certain drugs puts a strain on the cardio system. And the research team was acknowledging some previous research, which we'll talk about in a minute, that showed infections plus the use of the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory meds put you at high risk, is a high risk trigger for heart complications and heart events. and physicians in the study felt, you know, using an alternative pain reliever could be or should be considered as it may be a safer alternative if cardiac risk is a factor for you. Here is a quote from Dr. Cheng Chung Fang of the National Taiwan University Hospital. He says, physicians should be aware that the use of the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs during an acute respiratory infection might further increase the risk of heart attack. Patients seeking relief from cold and flu symptoms should consult with their doctor before using the non-steroidals. So, and here is the thing. They didn't want to point direct fingers. Of course, the research team didn't want to come out and say, hey, non-steroidals cause heart attack. They just said the research suggests there could be an increased risk. And of course, scientists, that standby answer is, additional research is needed. And the study did
Which means additional money is needed too, I think, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, the study stated that future research may be able to even identify which non-steroidals are safer than others, what additional illnesses combined with the drugs put you at a higher risk, and, you know, if previous heart conditions put you at risk of avoiding the drug altogether. But let's get to that previous research they mentioned. The Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania found that anti-inflammatory drugs increase the risk of cardiovascular events. This was a 13-year study, and that got published in May 2012 in the Journal of Science Transitional Medicine, Volume 4, Issue 132. So this study was prompted by the Vioxx scandal, which that drug was taken off the market for causing heart attacks and strokes, and some other similar drugs to Vioxx, they weren't taken off the market, but they acquired that black box warning you were asking about.
Mm-hmm.
So these drugs are what they call COX-2 and COX-1 drugs, and these are the culprits that are influencing our body enzymes and the prostaglandins, which can alter platelets, causing them to stick together, giving us an increased risk of cardiovascular problems. So the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs are really in the COX-2 subclass, and they're an inhibitor, and they're the most widely used drugs on the planet. So the class 1 non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like the naproxen, well, they caused, you know, some stomach upset, digestive problems. So that's why they came out with the COX-2 class. So for instance, Advil. And the COX-2 drugs, you know, they reduce the digestive complaints, but they cause the cardiovascular risk, see. So the Vioxx was taken off the market because it got such big press, but Celebrex was allowed to remain, and it has now strict guidelines with a black box warning on it. So the medical community, though, was aware that both of those drugs caused heart risks before they entered the market. Here's how we know. Pharmacologist and director of the Institute of Transitional Medicine and Therapeutics at Penn, Dr. Garrett Fitzgerald, he wrote a paper because he said he observed that both these drugs worked to suppress the compound in arterial walls that function as an anticoagulant and a vasodilator. So the drugs mess with the prostacylline compound, and the compound gets flushed out of your urine, and what he says this winds up doing is it causes hardening of the arteries. Oh,
so,
my goodness. Yeah.
I mean, this, and I'm going to guess, I mean, I'm very interested in this idea that anti-inflammatory products contribute to heart attacks, because the health community, the, you know, the vitamin, whatever, they've been advocating anti-inflammatory vitamins and strategies and the rest of that, I'll bet you, for a decade, claiming that everything goes back to inflammation. Now, are we talking about the same? Are they also actually making it more conducive to heart attacks? Or is it only the petrochemical drugs?
Well, apparently they do reduce inflammation.
Yeah.
But vasodilators have a lot to do with circulation. Okay. Okay, to give you an idea, Rogaine is a vasodilator for hair follicles, so your hair grows. Viagra is a vasodilator, so you know what grows. Okay? So it's important for blood flow, that there's an open passageway for the circulation to get into the small capillaries. And so with these COX-2 anti-inflammatory, so think of this as the next generation of anti-inflammatory meds. The first generation didn't cause this problem, but, you know, it created a lot of digestive issues. So they get rid of the digestive issues, but now they got heart issues, okay? So it does reduce inflammation, but it strips the circulatory system of its natural clotting agent and its ability for the arteries to remain flexible so that they can expand and allow blood flow. Does that make sense? And when you're talking about the areas that channel blood flow around the heart, your arteries and veins there, those are very hardy veins and arteries to be able to take the pressure from the heart muscle.
Yep.
And so when you start stiffening up those and taking away its ability to remain flexible and to expand and contract, you're going to have a problem. You're going to have a big one. So what Fitzgerald did in the lab is he took human blood in test tubes, and he observed what the drugs did to the blood itself, and he predicted that this drug would shut down the body's natural protection and cause heart attacks and strokes, and that's exactly what they did. Fitzgerald was able to prove his study. In April 2012, he wrote an article in the Proceedings of National Academy of Sciences, and he says he tested the drug on mice, and what it does to humans, it did to mice. And so this would suggest that the drug companies, because before you can get to a clinical trial on humans, you have to do animal trials. So this would suggest that the drug companies already knew this.
They it probably just skipped their mind.
Oh, I don't think so.
Don't think so?
I think this was a
profit overcame whatever other ethical obligation they might have to inform people, oh, this might kill you.
Well, I think the shredder got hold of that stuff, you know, and it just kind of disappeared. Because after 8 placebo-controlled random trials and 10 years and approximately 30,000 deaths, the drugs were finally declared a cardiovascular hazard. Okay. So the drug companies paid $950 million in settlement damages after the drugs netted them $5.5 billion. In sales.
Well, what can I tell you?
Well, this really truly amazes me how, you know, trusting we are in scientific medicine, because nowhere else in a business model can you charge extremely high prices, offer no refund or guarantees, and when patients die from the treatment, the responsible parties are really not harmed or financially damaged, really.
I understand they've paid Congress, they've bribed Congress with political campaign contributions to pass laws that grant the drug companies immunities, at least in some instances. I don't know how far the immunities extend, but they are at least relative to some drugs and maybe all of them. I don't know.
Well, it's really a legal business model that endorses and rewards negative outcomes.
I understand.
That's what it does. So if we look closely at a lot of toxic medical treatments, you're going to see where there are some negative outcomes that, you know, haven't been brought to the public's attention. So when was the last time you heard that a supplement killed 30,000 people, Al?
Never heard of it. Heard of such a thing.
But now all of a sudden you see all these articles in journals that doctors are reading on how bad supplements are. So it's now really more important that the patient look out for their own welfare and really do their homework on anything that's recommended. Anything that's recommended. Because, you know, over 20 years ago, I actually was a witness how herbs could do what I felt was the world's best kept secret. So, you know, and I don't think it was intended to be a secret. Because if we have scripture and we believe what the Bible says, when God says herbs are here for the service of man and for the healing of the nations, well, God can't lie about that, can he?
Yeah, but you can't patent those products. That was the big oversight in the Bible. They said, but you can patent these things and make a fortune off of them. But you can't.
Right. You can't steal God's copyright. You just can't do that. Right. But, you know, a lot of people, you know, they still get hung up on the scientific chemistry. You know, they get so enthralled with scientific chemistry.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I look at it this way. I tell people, so you think there's a better chemist than your creator?
Yeah.
Seriously, do you?
Well, there's another point. You know, back in the 50s, we were able to knock out smallpox, if I understand correctly. If I recall, it was smallpox, chickenpox, I don't remember which. We got rid of polio for all practical purposes. Uh-huh. That was defeated. I can remember you couldn't go swimming in Augustine back where I lived because people were afraid you were going to get polio when I was a little boy. That was science knocked that out. They don't do that anymore. When was the last time the pharmaceuticals created a product that actually cured a disease? All they do is suppress symptoms, so you come back and buy some more and buy some more and buy some more.
Right. Well, see, that their business model is managing disease.
Yeah.
So if they cure you, they don't have nothing to manage.
Yeah, that's right.
So where they do excel is trauma. You know, if you're in an accident, you know, they do excel there. You look like Humpty Dumpty and need a surgeon, you know, kind of thing. But when it comes to internal medicine issues, they really, their goal is, you know, is making you a patient for life. That's the goal.
Mm-hmm.
And to be on lifelong drugs, and really, that's not health. That's just, you know, that's just a buying time. And the inevitable is going to happen because when you try to control symptoms with toxicity, it creates a weakness, and eventually there's a failure when you have that going on. So look at things that strengthen you, and strengthening, you know, really increases your odds of, you know, regeneration and healing. So anybody's interested, if you're worried about the non-steroidals or the heart stuff, hey, there's the powerherbs.com. They have natural pain reliever anti-inflammatories there that don't have these side effects. And also, it's a heart health month, so 10% off the heart health strengthening formula, so take advantage of that. And if you don't have the internet for the powerherbs.com, give them a call, 866-229-3663, and we'll send you out a free catalog.
Well, you're not getting away just yet, because we have another 45 seconds to go here, and I want to be clear about this.
Okay.
You have anti-inflammatory products that do not have these side effects, and they do not increase the probability that... All right, I wanted to be sure. So people are saying inflammation is a bad thing. You agree inflammation is a bad thing, but you got to be careful what you take to solve that problem. True?
Right. So when you look at aspirin... In World War II, it was kind of discovered by accident around that time. They were looking for an anti-inflammatory, and a German chemist discovered salicin from willow bark and meadow sweet. But after they extracted it and isolated it from the other buffer alkaloids, it became acetylsalicylic acid, and that's what aspirin is today. So when you take away the buffer alkaloids and the mineral uptakes that helps the body use the salicin, you get side effects like bleeding and lowers fever, interferes with, you know, immune system. So when you use it in its whole state, it works much better, but without all that risk.
All right, Wendy, thank you very much. Always interesting. We look forward to talking to you next Wednesday. That's Wendy Wilson from thepowerherbs.com, 866-229-3663. Give her a call.
Kings have saw it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cedarstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cedarstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis here with Melody Cederstrom on Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. All your gold and silver coin needs. What's next, Melody?
I have a small little package today. We're going to up the gold. We're going to a quarter ounce. Ooh, a quarter ounce of an American Gold Eagle, 21-ounce silver eagles. This includes all your shipping costs for $765. So you get 21-ounce American silver eagles, 1/4 ounce of an American Gold Eagle, $765, includes all your shipping costs. So give us a call, 1-800-375-4188. No limits on this. If you want 100, we got them. You just have to give us a call and start preserving your purchasing power, and visit our website at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. Make sure you sign up for a weekly newsletter. Alfred?
Yes?
I do want to say one thing. I was telling Al during the break, I just didn't sleep last night, and I ended up watching some of those late-night news programs. I mean, I'm talking 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning. And even though I'm not shocked at the content of these programs, I was still shocked. I mean, it was nothing but Trump bashing. It was nothing then. It was all talk about impeachment. And I did tell someone a long time ago, I told several people, they will try to impeach him. But I figured they'd go after his conflict of interest in order to impeach him. But, now they're trying to impeach him because of, he's not mentally all there. And I was just, it was shocking.
Well, I understand.
To the amount of time that they spent and the hate and the untruths and how they view things. I'm thinking, are we on a separate planet or what?
We're on a planet that's engaged in a kind of civil war. We are in a planet, we are in a nation. There are forces at work that are bound and determined to impose a new world order. And if Trump gets in the way, those forces are not just going to roll over. They're going to fight him any way they can. And this is one of them.
I always knew they're not going to lay down, roll over, and go to bed, that they are going to fight. But I'm surprised at the...
They're fighting dirty, right? It would be one thing if they made arguments. But they're not trying to just make arguments. They're trying to use any angle they can devise, and they don't care how they win just as long as they win.
I thought they would do it a little more quietly, not through arguments and so forth. I figured they'd do it behind the scenes, and maybe they are. Maybe the true elite, the true rulers, are doing it behind the scenes, and they're just using the media as their little minions to produce the disruptions and so forth to, you know, keep everyone distracted while they do what they have to do to get things in place to fight the war. I don't know. But, it was interesting. As much as I hated it, it was interesting to just see the amount of detail and the amount of passion. It isn't just, oh, well, we don't like the guy and so forth. I mean, they have passion behind what they're talking. I mean, and it was very interesting.
I understand.
And there's, you don't even see that.
This isn't something to be rationally considered. This is something that's being sold and promoted and...
Yeah.
It's strident and it's Sieg Heil, and, you know, get the whole crowd to cheer at the same time, and you may get a real movement going. I don't know how much success they're having. They're certainly discrediting themselves. They're coming out. I mean, this is like Pravda in the former Soviet Union, where you understood, yeah, of course, they weren't telling you the truth. They were feeding you the government line. Well, these people aren't telling you the truth either. They're feeding you the establishment line. And a lot of people understand that. The question is, do more people understand this is propaganda, or do more people believe it as if it were true?
Well, I thought what I heard during the normal 8 hours of the day, you know, between, 5 in the morning to 8 at night was something. But listen to that late night talk. It was totally different. Totally different. Yeah, it was interesting.
You know, I just did an article last night on a radio program, American Independence Hour, that I do on Tuesday nights. And the focus of the program was, I recently had reason. I've been involved with a woman she's got a defamation suit going, and I've been helping her to some degree. And she's being sued for defamation. She's countersuing for defamation. I was forced to take a look at the 1922 Code of Ethics for Journalists in Oregon. 1922 Oregon Code of Ethics, or Journalist Code of Ethics for Oregon. I can't remember the exact title. And it was really illuminating to me. I really enjoyed reading that text. It was probably 8 or 10 pages. I don't remember how many pages it was altogether. But there were other texts available when I looked for Code of Ethics for Journalists or for Oregon Journalists. I Googled it. There were other texts, but this was the earliest one I could find, and it turns out this was the first one they ever had, and that's usually helpful because you can get the real deal. You can find out what's really going on frequently, not always, but what's really going on. You can find the foundation when you look at the original documents. And later documents on the Code of Ethics, some things might be concealed, or they are not apparent in the same way that they may be in that earliest document. And what was interesting to me is that when you read that document, you realized that the reason journalists are obligated to tell the truth, they cannot mislead the public, all right? Not ethically. It's unethical for them to mislead the public. And they're doing it all the time right now, or at least some of them are. And we have fake news and the rest of that. And we understand that we're getting more propaganda than news and objective information. They recognize in the Code of Ethics that people could make mistakes, but it's not the same thing as doing things intentionally feeding disinformation to the public. And they explained why the journalist has an obligation to serve the public by telling the truth as best they can understand it. And the obligation goes to the fact that journalism is protected by the First Amendment. The First Amendment is provided by the people of the United States of America. They said, okay, we're going to have freedom of the press. Okay, you get to be a journalist. If you want to be one, get yourself an outfit and be a journalist too. You can publish things, and this is abundantly clear in the internet age. You can publish things that used to require a staff. And you can put out a magazine all by yourself if you want to work hard at it. You know, depending on how frequently you want to publish it, there are great publishing opportunities, and the reason they aren't licensed is because we have freedom of the press, all right? Guaranteed. But the point in the Code of Ethics, 1922 Code of Ethics for Oregon journalists, the point they made there is that because the freedom of the press is there and provided by the people, therefore, the people are the beneficiaries. We are the beneficiaries of the press. And they have to do what's right for the people. They have an ethical obligation to tell us the truth because we provided the right, the freedom of the press that they're operating under. And if they don't want to, and the implication is that if they don't want to provide us with the truth, as near as it can be understood and discovered, if they want to use this as license, not a right, but as a license to do, to deceive and do, then they are in theory liable for ethical violations that we might actually be able to sue them for. They might be liable if you could show, no, you're giving us fake news and you're violating the First Amendment. You're violating a fundamental principle under the First Amendment. You're violating that principle. We get to stake a lawsuit to you and see how you like it.
Yeah, but you know what, Al? The problem is, yeah, there's fake news. It's distorted. It's embellished and so forth. I get that. On the other hand, these people believe what they say. You can't sue them for that. They have just as strong a belief in what they're promoting.
Well, if you can show
that
what they're saying
doing,
is false, if you can, I mean, it's not a cakewalk. I mean, freedom of the press to be protected, no question about it. But if you find evidence that someone is lying, in publishing lies, we have an argument now that I had not seen or understood previously, where we can go after.
But a lot of these comments and what's promoting a lot of these news programs, they believe what they're talking about.
I don't know if they really believe it or they don't believe it. I'm sure some do, but I'm sure some others get paid to fake it.
Probably.
Right? What
is the percentage? What is the percentage?
I have no idea. But
I mean, when you see these people talk late at night, what I'm talking about, they believe it. It is their passion.
No, they sound
not
like
lying.
They sound like they believe it, but watch
you can
a movie.
Have it on both sides too. Then.
Oh, I agree. It's more important that we preserve the freedom of the press than we sue people for defamation. That's no doubt true. We have to choose between it gets out of hand sometimes, or we have to get rid of freedom of the press. We're not getting rid of freedom of the press. Freedom of the press must be preserved. But if you can show that these guys are acting, they are intentionally lying. They are spreading propaganda rather than disseminating objective information. You have a basis that a jury might respond to.
Wouldn't that fall under defamation?
I'm not saying it wouldn't be defamation.
And I'm not arguing with you. I'm just.
No, I understand.
Is the press then the enemy of the people?
Well, it's like anything else. Some are, some aren't. You know, it's like are some cops abusive? Yeah, some are, some aren't. It's not. You can't just say everybody in the press is bad. You and I are in the press. All right, this radio program is about the press. It's an exercise in freedom of speech. It's an exercise in freedom of the press. All right, we're involved. We're operating under the First Amendment. We also have an obligation to try to tell people the truth. All right, doesn't mean we always succeed, but we cannot sit. It is unethical for us to sit and try to feed lies to the public. That's unethical. And what I'm seeing for the first time. First time for me, it doesn't mean it's not common knowledge to a lot of other people, but for the first time to me, I'm beginning to realize and understand that we have a cause of action that's tied to the First Amendment. If you're operating under the First Amendment, you have an obligation to tell the truth to the people who provided those rights. All right? If you violate, start lying, deceiving, they have an opportunity to come back and say, you're going to court. Huh? And then, you have an opportunity to counterclaim. Well, I know.
The point is what will be done.
Well, I get that. Not an easy thing. I'm not arguing that it's easy, but I am saying
it
previously.
It's a difficult thing to prove, just like treason. I mean, but how many people have actually been charged with treason? I mean, just in today's world.
Nowhere near as many as deserve it.
And in today's world, And I mean, I get it, and I know things aren't what they should be, and I think that's the importance of our program, is to dispel a lot of those mistruths, particularly in the finances.
Well, that's what we're
trying. And in other topics that we discuss. So it's certainly a period in time, and maybe that's why I'm just was shocked, because I can usually see the propaganda, you can usually see the lies, but I wasn't expecting their passion behind it last night. And that was what was surprising. I mean, they just weren't there reporting. I mean, they were
enraged.
and to impeach Mr. Trump because of his incompetence and so forth, and trying to find, use the 25th Amendment in order to, I was just... really interesting. So, folks, if you can't sleep at night and you still have
this, TV, won't help you. Don't watch this stuff because call Wendy Wilson. She has stuff that'll help relax you. It won't be the late night news. It will not relax you.
And therefore, there was a reason I could not sleep last night.
Exactly. You may have grounds to sue these people for keeping you awake,
Mel. Although,
they have an obligation to let people go to sleep instead of stirring them up in the middle of the night. I don't know if you get a good attorney. They might be able to make it work. Who knows?
Although it did get the circulation going.
Yeah, I understand.
So anyway, I just wanted to comment on that. And one more thing, we're going to be going to break here too. Big banks rack up $6.4 billion in ATM and overdraft fees. So just when everybody was feeling sorry for the banks because they, you know, weren't able to charge enough rates or, you know, whatever, you know, they racked up $6.4 billion. All of those, and all you who use your ATMs and, I mean, it's just like, you know, it's just disgusting that you have to pay $3 or more to get your own money out of the bank. It's just, you know.
I understand that. It isn't even money.
And that's just
on top of that, maybe
banks.
That's why you have to pay.
That's
because
just,
you're not really using money. You're using currency that's issued by a private entity called the Federal Reserve Bank. And it may be that part of the reason for the fees and the income taxes and the rest of that may be that you have been empowered to use these this currency, privatized currency. If you, for example, suppose I issued a currency. Well, if you were using it to pay your bills or your mortgages or whatever, if you were using Al's dollars, well, it's only right that Al gets a cut. You're using my currency. I issued it. Insofar as you're using it, it seems fair that I get a percentage on that, don't you think? Costs me money and time and effort to go out there and produce Al's dollars and distribute them where you people can use them if you care to. There's a good chance that part of the reason we get caught with the income tax and a lot of other, these fees and fines, you're not using real money. You're not using the people's money, which is gold and silver coin, as mandated within the States of the Union by Article 1, Section 10, Clause 1 of the Constitution of the United States. Right? It's there in the Constitution. No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. Got to have gold or silver coin. Article 1, Section 10, Clause 1. Don't have it. What does that prove? Proves either that the state governments are acting unconstitutionally every time they touch a Federal Reserve note, or that there's something that's happened to the states of the Union, and they have been somehow altered in a way where they're no longer obligated to provide gold and silver coin. Article 1, Section 10, Clause 1 says no state means state of the Union. It has nothing to do with territories or districts like Washington, D.C., where Federal Reserve notes are completely legal. They are not legal, technically. Constitution says, hasn't been amended, hasn't been repealed. Something's going on with our monetary system. I mean, read the Constitution. Article 1, Section 10, Clause 1, and you will discover there's a very strange problem here. We're going to take a break for some more commercials, and we'll be back in just a moment on Financial Survival. Please stay tuned.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey water filtration systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis here with Melody Cederstrom on Financial Survival. And we were talking, Melody was talking about expressing her displeasure. It cost her $3 to get her money out of the ATM machine.
No, I don't use their money. Well, you know, and we're talking about the three banks that raised the $6.4 billion, and you know, I know everyone knows who they are: J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, and Wells Fargo. They're the ones that earned the $6.4 billion, and that works out to about $25 in fees annually for every adult American.
Mm-hmm.
And so the big three banks collected nearly $300 million more in ATM and overdraft fees in 2016 than they did in 2015. So the ATM revenue just for J.P. Morgan alone jumped 22%. I mean, that's huge.
Yeah, I know. Just working harder, Melody, to serve you.
Oh yeah, and they're closing down more. Yeah, they make more money doing this than the ATMs. They're closing down all the branches, so they get to lay off all the people. You know, that are usually that work in the lobbies, the tellers, and so forth. So they're saving money there. So again, you know, if you follow the money, folks.
Yeah, and better be prepared to run fast because it's moving quickly from place to place. But here's an article that was, I can't even remember who was, who inspired this. It ultimately traces back to India. India prints new 1,000-rupee notes 3 months after banning them. Right? You may recall that on November 8th, India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi decided to suddenly withdraw 500 and 1,000 rupee notes from India's economy. These are paper notes, and they didn't want them because people were hoarding them and using them. They were storing them in their mattress, whatever, and they weren't easily taxed. Government couldn't identify who had them. They said this was black market money. It was legitimate. It wasn't counterfeit, but they were saying the people aren't putting their money in the economy, and they're not putting it out where we can tax it, and they had to get rid of the 500 and 1,000 rupee notes. The ultimate objective was to push the people into taking plastic, right? They would accept debit cards, essentially. And each one, you'd have one, I'd have one, Melody'd have one, and we'd have your name on it, your PIN number, and your serial number, and the rest of that sort of thing. And you would conduct your transactions with plastic and digital currency, and the government, of course, would be able to monitor every single transaction. You couldn't buy or sell anything without using some plastic. And the government would be able to monitor everything. They would be the third party to every transaction that you engaged in. Well, that would mean that they would tax you on site. You wouldn't have to worry about paying taxes next April 15th. We'd tax you right now. You spend money now, we tax you right now. Well, again, November 18th, they decided to withdraw the 500 and 1,000 rupee notes from India's economy. His purpose, again, was to force the Indian people to accept digital monetary system owned and operated by India's government and or the Central Bank of India. Modi's decisions that sent shockwaves through India's largely cash-based economy and was seen as the establishment's first major attack on in the war on cash. We've all heard for the last 6 months, maybe nine, less than a year, that people say, oh, we've got to get rid of cash to protect us from the drug dealers and the terrorists and the rest of that, and we have to go digital. bunk. They want to control you. They want to monitor you. And it looked like the war on cash was succeeding. Right? Here's India, whole nation. Right? It seemed certain that the cash would soon disappear from India's economy and as well as the economies of other countries. However, India even limited the withdrawals from bank savings accounts. Right? The Indian government would, by Shiva, that's the one of the Hindu gods, of course, subject all the people of India to government control by monitoring all of their commerce with digital rupees. As a result of eliminating the 500 and 1,000 rupee notes, those were the two biggest notes they had in India, and they were worth some. I think one of them was worth, the big one was worth the equivalent of $15, and the smaller one was worth $7. They took them all out. One of the results was huge queues formed at banks as Indians lined up and fought to find alternative ways of payment. Now, while the government's, India's government assumed that, of course, if the government eliminated government-issued paper rupees, the Indian people would naturally be forced to use government-issued digital rupees, which India's highly beloved and honorable government could easily track and tax. However, much to the Indian government's surprise, the Indian people began to buy, sell, trade, and save with the private digitized Bitcoin, right? Which India's government did not issue, did not control, and could not easily monitor and tax. In fact, following India's removal of the 500 and 1,000 rupee notes, the Indian people did not, as expected, they've defied expectations, they did not adopt the government's digital rupees, but instead became the world's number two Bitcoin discount marketplace. So, earlier this month, in February, of course, India's central bank issued a public warning against the use of bitcoins and cryptocurrencies. You can't be using that phony money provided by these private sources. You have to use phony money provided by the government and by the central banks. That was essentially the basis of the warning. And they should have issued the warning because, after all, Italy's only product, the India's central bank, their only product is paper and digitized rupees. If the Indian people start conducting commerce with untraceable, untaxable bitcoins, India's central banks would be useless, irrelevant, and could perish. The Indian people were implicitly warned that if they kept on using Bitcoin, they might destroy their beloved central bank, which had already done so much for so many over so many years, which I'm being facetious, of course. However, yesterday, 3 months ago, they take the 500 rupees out, take the 1,000 rupee notes out. They give people warnings. Don't be using these Bitcoin. Don't be using Bitcoin digital currency. Got to use India's digital currency, not Bitcoin, India's. All right. Yesterday, India announced that it is set to reintroduce its outlawed 1,000 rupee note. That's just 3 months after the government withdrew it as part of currency reforms. Apparently, thanks to the creation of Bitcoin, the first full national attack on paper currency has failed. Modi's government is in full retreat and forced to reinstate 500 and 1,000 rupee paper notes in order to, hopefully, from their perspective, prevent the Indian people from adopting Bitcoin and rendering all government-issued rupees, both paper and digital, irrelevant and obsolete. The local news resource, Indian Express, is an Indian publication, reported that production of the new incarnation of the note has already started, although it was as yet unclear when it would enter circulation. Production would have started in January. Senior government official told the Indian Express, but has been delayed due to pressing need to supply 500 rupee notes. We're going to get that. They should have had, they expected the 1,000 notes to go in January, the 1,000 rupee notes, but they had a more pressing note to supply 500 rupee notes, and so they're doing those first, and they'll get to 1,000 later. Now, for now, it appears that the war on cash has suffered a terrible defeat. Not just in India, but globally. I'm sure that every government that's trying to get rid of untaxable cash and force people to use taxable, government-issued, government-monitored digital currency is having second thoughts. as long as Bitcoin, other cryptocurrencies, and even gold and silver remain available. The people of the world have monetary choice. Right? They're no longer trapped into using digitized rupees or euros or even dollars. I have no doubt that the cornerstone of the one world government, the New World Order, is a single digitized currency controlled by that one world government. It is an extraordinary irony that just about the time the world's governments were about to eliminate paper cash and impose a global digitized currency, a number of alternative digital currencies, digital currency technologies have appeared that so far threaten the very existence of central bank controlled digital currency. Simple truth is this: anything you can digitize, I can digitize better. I can digitize anything better than you. And I'm speaking from the perspective of a private individual talking to the governments and banks of the world. You want digitized currency? I can make digitized currency. I have no idea how many Bitcoin-like products are available, but there are masses of them. If I said 24, I'd probably be short. If I said 50, I might be closer to target, but I don't know what the number is. They are growing and growing, and they have to scare government dramatically. As long as governments rely on official digital currencies to control the world, there's no reason why the people of the world can't choose to create and use their own privatized digital currencies to free themselves from government control and taxation. And the implication, now, I'm not here to advocate digital coin. Right? In fact, I think that all things that are not physical, including all forms of wealth that are not physical, including paper and digital, I think they are inherently risky. But to avoid succumbing to the attraction of privatized digital currencies like Bitcoin and maintain their financial power, governments of the world may be forced to start reissuing physical currencies because physical currencies can't be digitized. Right? Those physical currencies could be made from paper, but paper is easy and inexpensive to counterfeit. If government really wants to control the national and or global monetary systems, they're going to need to base money. They're going to need a base money that is physical, not digital, and can't be easily counterfeited. And to me, that means gold or, to a lesser degree, silver. Government, what are they going to do with all these digital currencies, Melody? I mean, now there is a real competition. They are threatening the government. Bitcoin was indirectly, but implicitly, threatening government control in India of their financial system. Right? And they had to reverse this. Oh, no, okay. Don't use digital. We're going back to physical. We're going back to paper, at least. That's semi-physical. Right? I'm thinking to myself that the pressure we're seeing here, if the government wants to maintain its power and its authority over issuing the dollar, it was Rothschild who said, I don't care who makes the laws as long as I get to control the money. All right, words to that effect. Our governments around the world have embraced that philosophy for 40, 50 years or more. They have been issuing the currency, and therefore they don't care about who makes the law as long as they get to issue the money or what passes for money. Huh? Well, now they have lost that control. Insofar as they've gone digital, they don't have that control anymore. What are they going to do, Melody? I don't know, but to me, this suggests that somebody's going to have to say, okay, you could do Bitcoin digital or you could do government digital, and the difference is that government digital is backed by gold. You can get it. You want to do digital? Okay. You can use government digital. I won't say it's a perfect solution, but if you wanted to turn it in for gold, physical gold, you can do that. I think maybe, and I'm not telling you it's God's truth, I'm not saying this is an absolute certainty, but I think maybe that's where this is going. Government can't control digital. They can't control it. And if they can't control it, do they want it? And the answer is no. And if they can't control digital, it tells me they have to go physical. And if they're going physical, then that means, I think, it doesn't mean special drawing rights from the International Monetary Fund. It doesn't mean some other digital currency to back up the digital currency we've already got. It means to me that there's got to be a physical There's got to be a physical money that's backing. If we're using digital currency, it's the best digital currency will be backed by gold. And what would the price of gold be, Melody, if they actually started backing government dollars with gold?
Well, of course it would be much higher.
Way higher. Way higher. John Williams at ShadowStats.com, he was just fooling around, but he's a credible guy. He's a serious man and the rest of that sort of thing. And the one guy in the whole world that I regard as a real hero, he has suggested that gold could go as high as $100,000 an ounce. Now, he doesn't seriously believe that in the sense that he's advocating and predicting it. He's not predicting that, but he's saying it could happen. If it happened, if government has to back its digital currency with gold, that's not impossible. It's not impossible, but 20,000, 50,000, I don't know. You know, a lot of people think that's credible. As far out as it sounds, a lot of people sit back and say, well, you know, it could happen. But maybe it's only going to 5,000 or 10,000. I don't know what's going to happen, but it's clear. India has given us good evidence that the governments can't control digital. They can't really control it, and that means to me, that tells me if they want to maintain control, they've got to go back to physical, and that means gold or silver at base. Doesn't mean everybody's got to have gold coins in their pocket, but it does mean the government has to go back to backing its currency. And you know, we'll talk about this tomorrow perhaps. Alan Greenspan has recently been interviewed where he spoke out strongly in favor of gold. I think it's not just a theoretical conversation. I think he's telling the world, I'm guessing, I can't prove it strong, it's a long shot, but I'm guessing he's saying, we're going back to a gold-based currency. This whole paper thing, this fiat thing is going down. I think Greenspan, if you read him closely, I think he's alerting the world we're going back to gold. We'll see. Maybe true, maybe false, but it's interesting information, interesting conjecture. We're out of time, folks. I want to thank all of you for listening. Melody and I will be back tomorrow. In the meantime, may the good Lord bless you and me and Melody and Todd the producer. Bye-bye.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me.
That's too bad.